You're listening to the Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. Conversations about community media. Visit decentered.co.uk or follow on Instagram and Twitter at Decentered Media. Hello, it is Tuesday the 8th of April. I'm Rob Watson and this is a Decentered Media podcast. And I'm really pleased to be joined today by Kieran Murray, who is the CEO and founder of OLAS. So I'm going to get you to tell us who you are, what you do, and what is OLAS. How's it there? Where are you based, by the way?
Hi, Rob, by the way. Thanks for having me. I'm based in Dublin. So is the OLAS Foundation, which is stewarding development of OLAS, the decentralized media platform that we're trying to build. Who am I? I am a guy with a background in social sciences, economics and political science. Then I went to work in BSkyB in London. So in media, but more the ad side of things, the evil part of it. But even then, I had a massive interest in how media was produced, and they actually started sending me out to Austerlitz with a view to working in the news department. But then I ended up leaving and going to work in the European Commission in DG Trade. When this is around 2011, someone sent me the Bitcoin white paper, and having a background in economics, because a huge amount of economics, it's not just computer science, it's at the intersection of economics and computer science, basically. It blew my mind. And within 6 months, I had left the commission and I've been in Web3, which I now call it. Some people call it crypto and blockchain. I'm at the app layer, so I like to call it Web3. Since then, basically, so 13, 14, 15 years, mainly as a researcher, investor. And then a few years ago, I got an itch to build something. We first threw our hat in the ring in a thing called synthetic assets, which are basically cryptocurrencies that can track the value of anything that has a number in the world. You know, how many days is going to rain in a year, how many goals Messi will score in a season, whatever, you name it. But it does it without a broker, investment bank, anything. So it was just completely peer-to-peer. But in the kind of centralized world, that's really heavily regulated stuff. And regulators started taking a close look at people who were working on that stuff. And I was like, we're just a startup. I don't need a big US three-letter agency coming after me. So we kind of sunsetted that. We launched it and we did a 6 months, what we call a liquidity farming program that was a success. There was no hack, which in Web3 is always a bonus. And then I had my head turned to do this media project, having the kind of background I did, short and all as it was in Sky, but generally just have a massive interest in media, huge, voracious reader of media, of numerous subscriptions, even long before I was doing market research for this, and was following with some concern the direction of travel and both, you know, economically and then the quality of the product, the decline in trust in these institutions that we rely on so heavily. And then having this background and knowledge of Web3 and all these other tech tools that were coming out about a year and a half ago, I just saw this, all these pieces come together basically of a jigsaw where I could see this future where we can build a better media system from the ground up. And that's, I guess, where we are now.
Also, I mean, I suppose what we're going to do is unpack that, yeah, and the different stages. I'm just wondering which is more the best thing to start with, the kind of definitions in terms of what we mean by blockchain and crypto and that kind of thing, mm-hmm, and or the challenge of the loss of trust in media institutions and news values, that kind of thing. Let's go for the blockchain. Let's give the depth, because this is kind of like the technical bit of it, if you like, and then thinking about, because it's how it's then applied to media will be, maybe I'll follow through with that to kind of circle back around into that. So sure. the kind of overview when you're talking to, you know, kind of the general member of the public,
the Eli Five, as we call it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Explain cool. like I'm five.
All right. Okay. That's the yeah, yeah. I'm six. So that's it. Give you a little bit of a nudge. Yeah.
You know, absolutely. And I keep it, blockchain's massively broad with huge amounts of use cases. But the area I think that's relevant to what we're talking about is what has become to be known as Web3, which is the extension of the internet protocols, open protocol stack to the application layer. If you think about the internet as a protocol stack, you've got TCP/IP at the bottom, which is a communications protocol, HTTP, Tim Berners-Lee's invention, which basically enabled us to create, it was a standard for information, I guess, on this communications protocol that enabled us to build websites that could talk to each other. But then on top of that, and Berners-Lee's dream, of course, that we'd all have our own websites and would all be this decentralized modular system. And unfortunately, the economics of that didn't stack up. The UX people weren't just, you know, bothered, because it's not quite a straightforward thing setting all these things up, having your own server. Basically, big tech took over. And the application layer of the internet became dominated by private businesses and ever more concentrated. And Web3 is the dream, I guess, but also the technological step that enables us to bring the protocols, open protocol stack to the application layer. So you can have Twitter, you can have Facebook, you can have Instagram, you can have whatever, a brokerage, anything, at the application layer, and it's not controlled by anyone. It's an open application as well. A protocol is probably a better word. And then we are obviously going to be a media application of this. So we are building an open publishing platform with many other things attached, bells and whistles, you know, decentralized quality controls, so crowd editorial review, essentially. Crowdfunding models, community-based funding models, stuff like that. But the blockchain element is the bit that makes an ownerless media platform possible. So yeah, hopefully that explains it.
Yeah, in an analogy, what's the work in it? What's the best analogy that you've got for people? So is it, you know, often, yeah, the information superhighway is defined as, you know, like a motorway with lanes of traffic or whatever. There's always an analogy that kind of people use with these things. What's your go to analogy?
Bloomberg without Michael Bloomberg, or Sky without Rupert Murdoch. The first media platform in history since the dawn of the printing press that isn't controlled by somebody. So, yeah.
So it has because it uses a network, it just exists within the network, but not having a, if you like, an anchor point within that network where
no central authority. Yeah, right. Exactly. No central authority. And it just exists in this decentralized network of computers. It's secured by economic incentives. And once it's uploaded by us, the creators, we just become another person, you know, a user on this platform. We're at the exact same level as everyone else. We can exert no control anyone else can.
So the obvious question that comes to mind is, what stops that descending into chaos and, you know, the Wild West, if you like, of everybody just doing things for themselves?
Yeah. So this is where mechanism design comes in, and it's very, very complicated stuff. And it took us a year in R&D essentially before we even announced our mechanisms to the world, because this is when you give something to the crowd, you know, in many ways, it's great to get rid of the Rupert Murdochs of this world. But also, if you've seen the crowd on the internet, the mob can be awful. You know, there is wisdom in the crowd, but you have to, in order to harness it, you have to develop very careful systems to extract that wisdom and push back against the misinformation. So, and that's just the quality control aspect of things. Then you have funding side of things. Who's funding who? If you don't have careful controls in place, you may find that Elon Musk is actually just paying a whole lot of people behind the scenes. And then you actually haven't got rid of hierarchies. You've made it worse. You've made them opaque. at least I know where Rupert Murdoch stands. I know where Michael Bloomberg stands. I have my eyes wide open on that. But on a decentralized platform where you don't protect against collusion, bribery, people buying outcomes, you actually end up making something worse. It'd be very dystopian. So we have a huge amount of protocols in place. So starting at the funding level, we use a thing called quadratic funding. So let's say you are a journalist in Leicester and you want to write on cricket and you have no money yet. So you make a proposal to our protocol, this quarterly funding rounds, and to write on cricket. And you go around to your local community and go, I need to raise, I don't know how many thousand here. This is for a quarter, right? And what keeps a journalist going? Quite a few thousand. Who wants this content? And you go around and let's say you get donations from 200 or 300 people, small donations to write. You get matched from a global matching pool that we envisage will be funded by governments, local governments, even big tech, LLMs who want good information and don't want to have agreements with centralized authority. They can just put money in a big pot, but then crucially, they have no influence over how this money gets spent. The more donors you have relative to the amount of money you've raised, the bigger amount you get from this matching pool. So it's kind of a cross between democracy and markets. So then let's say you've raised your 20, 30 grand, whatever it is, to go off and write on cricket. Every single time you write an article on cricket, you have to stake a bit of money. All that money goes in escrow. You don't just get it because people could just run away with it. When I say escrow, it's a smart contract on the blockchain. Nobody can get it. So you stake 100 quid on an article, 20 quid of that goes as a bounty to readers to find fault. So they're actually incentivized to find fault. And then if they do, a small committee is formed, randomly selected by other people on the platform, other journalists who have put down cricket as an area of interest or an area of knowledge. And then a few seats are left open as well to randomers so that it guards against collusion and groupthink. Now, cricket's probably a bad example for collusion and groupthink, you know, but when it gets to political stuff, you need to guard against this stuff. And they will, bit by bit, give a pass judgment on each issue between the prosecution and the defense, almost the journalist and the fact checkers. They'll give the article an overall score. The journalist will get, let's say they got a score of 87, they got 87% of their stake back, the remainder of their stake. And then also tips that flow in. We're going to use a tipping model because the beauty of Web3 enables cash-like payments. It basically creates internet cash. So when you scroll to the bottom of the article, you don't have to whip out your credit card. You don't have to sign up to anything. It's not a subscription. You literally just like a like on social media, you know, I'll give that 20 cent. So we expect a huge amount of revenue opportunities to open up from that user experience. And the journalists will also only get 87% of those tips. And the remaining 13% will go back into that big global matching pool I told you about that will fund future journalism, fund future fact checkers and jury members. So it's all self-sustaining in that way.
What has drawn you to adopt this model? Do it in this way? I mean, the thing that comes out and the kind of fault line on this is about trust, isn't it? Trust and integrity. And in the past, we've typically put our trust in institutions to do the kind of verification.
It's all about reputation. Yeah.
Well, reputation's different from, I suppose, status as well, because you can have a reputation, but you can be quite low status. You can be high status and have a poor reputation. You know, sometimes the Church of England oscillates around this on a daily basis. But that trust element is kind of regulated over time, and people often don't necessarily want or need to question that on a daily basis. But with news and information, this is kind of set up in a different kind of way. So keep circling these things as I figure out what the next step is with this. But what's the problem with the old model?
in turn, the revenue, the old revenue model, are the old quality control model.
The content delivery. I mean, first of all, I kind of think looking at media from purely a instrumental and transactional point of view, that it's about delivery of content, whether that's be news and information. I think that's fundamentally flawed, because people don't just engage with media on that basis. They have a whole broad range of things like symbolic engagement, a sense of belonging, a sense of identity, a sense of symbolic, if you like, account for the past, and a symbolic potential for the future. But so the danger is that this gets narrowed down to just an information exchange.
I'm not necessarily, because the funding aspect is rooted in the community. So they're kind of your editorial direction right there. You've gone to them with a proposal, and they're going to expect you to. And by the way, you're going to be constantly engaging with them. These people who donated to you aren't just going to walk away and go, you go do what you're going to do. So your entire content delivery is rooted in your communities. Now, that's a separate thing to the quality control.
Let's establish what you mean by community first, and then we can look at the quality control from that. So how's your model come up? Because your background is social sciences. So looking at community, there's many different ways of looking at community and establishing the sense of community and coming up with definitions about that. What's been your go-to or guiding principles for what a sense of community is in this? What's not worked in the past and what you'd like to see working in the future?
Okay, so in this, it is a more, well, it's a narrow and broad sense. A community here is your set of donors, your set of your readership, and that can be local, it can be national, it can be transnational. It is your topic and following, people who are interested in that topic and demand this product. But our current media models outside of a select few are failing. There's a market failure, because despite the fact there is demand for these products, either way, advertising has gone on the internet. That's not a sustainable model for so many anymore. Subscriptions are also only really sustainable for a select few, because the amount of money you have to pour into marketing them, then also running them at their loss for a while. When you sign up a subscription, you always get an X amount of months discount or even free. They hook you. And then while you're using the platform, they expend a huge amount of money into figuring out what you're doing to retain your business. And that is, there's only so many subscriptions we'll all take out. So a thing called subscription fatigue kicks in, and whole swaths of information is just not getting produced because of that, despite the facts that people want. And so I guess the people that want these things, that's your community. And we're trying to connect them to journalists in a much more direct way and an accountable way.
I think there's a really good distinction, which I'm very happy with, that you've made, which is that you haven't mentioned audiences. And most of the mass media model and people who have facilitated and managing mass media or institutions and organizations still talk about audiences, and they're not talking about communities of people that they engage with. So it's that that is a significant change to actually have a platform kind of approach, which says, no, this is about founding communities.
Yeah, like there's literally going to be pretty much an ongoing dialogue between the journalist and their community / donors in terms of how they're delivering their content. So it's a far more connected model.
So what? Then you've got that kind of. So we've got a shift in from the mass media model, which typically brings large audiences to, you spend an awful lot of time and effort doing content which delivers a mass audience to advertisers, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is about forming communities, and examples of this would be, initially would be something like Substack is a good example of the way that a lot of people, a lot of journalists have now left institutions and started up their own Substack channels, and they're doing content with on that. This goes slightly beyond that, but it's a more integrated network approach than just merely Substack subscription.
There are similarities in the sense that you are the captain of your own ship. It's just kind of you. Now, there are huge collaboration tools, because journalism requires that. but essentially you are you. You're not working for an institution, and that, and Substacks like that. Also, we're not naive. So some of these, it will be a little bit of a pyramid, and the people at the top will be mass media. You know, the top people, the Iglesiases, the Greenwalls of this world on Substack earn millions a year. They have a huge following, and there will be some sort of power law like that. But we definitely are going to try and mitigate that with this funding model. As soon as you get to a certain level, you're not going to be able to enter funding competitions. You know, if you're making, coining it and tips on our platform, why should you be getting donations as well? There's that. Also, it's not just a blogging platform. We expect this to look and feel like a newspaper. There's going to be photographers on it. There's going to be collaboration tools. There are going to be curators who will be almost the modern day editors who will build newspapers. And this might be AI, by the way. You might be, a reader might just say, it's completely modular. A reader might just say, anytime X journalist writes, I want him in my daily newspaper. Anytime there's an article about this cricket team, anytime there's an article on climate change, whatever. And your daily newspaper gets constructed in your image every day. And yeah, you may have three or four different newspapers. I'm sure you will. Some curated by humans, some by AI. Where was I? I've forgotten what the point of this was.
It's the shift from a centralized to a decentralized.
Oh, yeah. So there will be certain centralized elements in the sense that some curators will end up pouring loads of money to get huge distribution. They'll probably have the top journalists. There will be the New York Times of this world on this. The point is that won't mean there doesn't have to be a local. There doesn't have to be, the niche doesn't have to get squeezed out. There's room for them all on it.
Do you think, one of the challenges at the moment, I mean, for example, the BBC media, the BBC's charter renewal is about to start to take place. And there's lots of lobbying going on in the background. And I'm involved in a forum which looks at this. And there still is here in the UK, there's maybe it's kind of under pressure, maybe it's being tested, but there's still a kind of residual faith and trust in an institution, a national institute, state-based institution like the BBC to provide content for people.
Yeah.
What have you, kind of gleaned from sitting in the pub on a Friday evening, about people and watching people in terms of what their needs are? Because, you know, it's that thing I always like, that I've repeated this many times. I think Steve Jobs got it from Henry Ford. If you'd have asked people at the end of the 19th century, how would they like to improve their personal mode of transport? Most people would have said a more comfortable saddle.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have invented and created the motor car. Now, we're dealing with the problems of overinvestment in motor cars, but that's a different topic. You know, what is it that when people see rather than hear about this, that you think that you've observed in people that you think, you know, can what's driving this?
So I don't think there's a massive mystery here. I think there is clear demand for both trustworthy media and local niche media, and also there is an entertainment aspect. People do like a, you know, we don't, you can't, let's not be naive here. People do want some sort of hook that makes them click and read. But what we were trying to do is rebalance a bit completely away from just this clickbait to also a bit of substance to everything. But the problem is the current economic models are not monetizing this demand. They're failing. So we just see, and we believe we have a way of doing that, where the needs that are there, the demand for trustworthy, entertaining content can be met financially for journalists, basically.
So the problem is the infrastructure, the delivery processes, mechanisms that are actually. There is a need. I mean, I use this rule of thumb now about community media, which I'm happy to repeat ad nauseum because I think it's quite neat. Mm. It's that most of our media is concerned with telling us what we should be concerned about, and very little of our media is concerned about giving us the tools and skills for what we care for. So it's often about, you know, as you say, the clickbait kind of approach you care about the environment, you watch natural history programs, you like David Attenborough's voice, therefore you care about the environment. And when you say, but your neighborhood that you live in is a bit of a dump, and you know your boiler's not working, and you know you can, but you've got your family to keep, and we need the, it's that shift from kind of thinking it's okay, everybody's running around like headless chickens telling us what we should be worried about, but actually on a practical level, what really people want to do is to go, well, look, you know, I've got to put a shelf up, and I need, as an analogy, I've got to put a shelf up and I need something practical for this. Who do I turn to? So YouTube's big on this.
Yeah.
You want to do something, you want to, you know, so the kind of people who can invest in, a friend of mine's an electronic engineer, and he works on cars, and he's retired now, and he does little short YouTube videos about how to change carburetor heads and things like that. Whatever.
It's informative stuff. Yeah.
Yes, but the mechanism that feeds and rewards and returns some value back to him isn't there, because you have to go down the influencer clickbait, you know, salacious headlines kind of stuff, and create some kind of indignation. Not, this is just a little video about how to boil an egg.
I know, you have to have those, YouTubers do it, these big capital letters. Even the really good content have to do that just to get the click. And this is what I'm talking about. We can't be that naive. I think we do always have to have that hook. But what we were trying to do is balance that. So I think you mentioned there, people do respond to outrage. We have this love-hate relationship with the news where we can't help ourselves clicking on this negative, inaccurate, outrage-inducing view of the world. And we go and read it, and then we go and our trust becomes lower in media. So it's this almost this negative feedback loop where we keep clicking this stuff. That's the thing that makes media money. And then we're left unsatisfied. So we are part of the problem, the readers. So the way to balance that, I believe, is that if you create these bounties, these incentives, where someone gets to pull you up and go, well, you're missing context here, or that's actually factually incorrect, and that affects your payout. It's not just a click anymore. You have to somewhat, you're in the game for tips, so you have to somewhat care about clicks, but you have to balance that with accuracy and hopefully, as you said, something more constructive for readers.
How would you prevent clicks for hate in that circumstance? Is that, I mean, a friend of mine is a photographer, and the first thing, he runs a YouTube channel, and they said the first thing he learned was to put deliberate mistakes and errors in there, says, because that drove the viewership. Most people were then said, this is clearly wrong.
And he just sums up the whole model, like, the,
you know, and it's like, and he was rewarded from, you know, that the reward is given on the basis that he's actually put something in there to annoy people, because that's the way that he got engagement with people. So we're running against a kind of model of human nature in a way, aren't we? It's like,
yeah, exactly. You're right. And again, I stress, it's about getting that pendulum back in the middle a bit. Instead, if you just go completely factual, correct, completely straight down the middle, you're not going to get engagement. And we've got to be realistic about that. But that's intriguing. Like, it's just like, I'll actually purposely make mistakes to get it.
Well, it works. I mean, I'm sure, you know, there's plenty of people out there who do it. And as you say, it's just, you know, but the reward infrastructure is to enable people to do that, and those people who are a bit more so, it's because one of the advances, I mean, one of the things I, you know, constantly say about community media is that, okay, you know, it's a patchwork, and lots of people are doing very different things in very different ways all over the place, and there's no central model for this, and nor should there be, but you're embedded within a town or a neighborhood or a community that will pull you up if you get something wrong. So that accountability model at the heart of this is that community means accountability. There's a relationship between the two. There's a link between the two.
Yeah, there's the accountability in the sense of your donors have kind of given you an editorial direction. You've come to them with I'm going to write on X. And if you start writing on Y, well, first of all, the protocol will prevent you, because you would have had to put in a tag saying, I'm going to write on this topic. And you won't be completely handcuffed by that. Like, sometimes you might just, something big happens in the world, you might have something to say about it, but you'll still have to have 80, 70, 80% of your articles on the thing you raised money for. So there's that accountability. And then second of all, there's the, what we call the editorial, I guess, accountability in terms of your contextual and factual accuracy, the quality of your opinions. And that is we believe what I was talking about there, we're taking a little bit away from the entertainment clickbait side of things. But if we empower the readers to actually, every time they're reading an article, they're kind of like, can I? So even if they don't, they're still studiously trying to, because they know there's something in it for them. It increases their rep score. And then at the end of the month, they can get a protocol rebate, and actually reading the news becomes profitable for them. And that, I think, and also there's a competition. You're against other readers. You know, there's a big leaderboard in this and stuff. So that brings the other entertainment competitive aspect, that the type of person who would have responded to that YouTube guy going, actually, no, that's wrong. They get a sense of reward, while the journalist himself or herself doesn't feel the need to put in actually stuff wrong to get engagement. You're getting it anyway. So that's the plan.
So it's like, I mean, at the moment, it feels like people are, you know, you look at local news in, I don't know what it's like in Ireland, but you look at it in the UK and the kind of press, what was formerly the press. And it is very much kind of driven by just clickbait, not rubbish. I mean, it is junk media. You know, I tried 10 cafes and this was the best breakfast. You know, these are my favorite packs of crisps, you know, just with generic trash articles, which, you know, on their own can be mildly amusing. But when you look at it from a systemic level and you realize that 80 or 90% of the content that's being, you know, trolled out by these organizations, and I'm thinking of Reach PLC, is very much a case of it's counterproductive, because everybody I speak to, and I use my browser of choice is Firefox, and it does a pretty good job of blocking ads. Everybody else I speak to says they can't read their local newspaper online because they're it's just, you know, it's garbage ads keep popping up. So it's kind of like a self-destructive, you know, kind of mode that they're in.
This is it. It's a complete negative feedback loop. The way the internet is structured in terms of human nature, the responses to negativity or clickbait like that, and also the fact that you're no longer just competing with our newspapers. It's all out attention warfare on the internet. The story I always tell is, like, when newspapers, the press back in the day, the pre-internet press, when they were competing with each other, the only moment they were really competing with each other is when a person walked into a shop and they looked up at the shelf and they go, which newspaper are going to read? And that's why the headlines were always a little bit sensationalist, because that's the bit that got someone hooked and they went and bought the newspaper. But once they brought the newspaper home, the newspaper had them. So the second, third, fourth, fifth pages were able to just get down to business of what we're supposed to be doing as journalists. Now, you're not only competing on an article by article basis online, you're competing with just nonsense posts, or like anything on. So you have to, basically, it's become lowest common denominator.
That thing that always happens, the postman's at the door. Bear with me.
Oh, right. Okay.
How does that happen on a podcast? I don't know. So, a friend of mine he lives in Cardiff and he speaks Welsh, and Russell, and he once told me that the headlines in Welsh are nowhere near as sensational as the headlines in English on newspapers.
Really?
I was going to ask you a question about, you said you've worked in Europe and you lived in London. What have you learned from, you know, you're now back in Dublin, is that correct?
Correct, yes.
So what have you learned from that, your experience of mixing with and into, you know, kind of circulating amongst different groups of people within different places?
Sure. I do think, of all the countries I've lived in, the UK has definitely got the most sensationalist press. It's definitely the most dominated by tabloids. And as a result, also has one of the lowest trust ratings. Now, the BBC is obviously an exception. BBC by global standards, but it's still only like 50% trusted. But that's as good as it gets these days. You know, I think the Nordic countries, their main publications, pretty much all their publications are up at those levels as well. Really high trust society up there. France actually seems to have quite a diverse and trusted media landscape as well. Ireland also rates quite highly in media trust, but I think the writing's on the wall for a lot of local news as well, but it's not a particularly tabloid dominated. I think that's very unique to the UK. But no matter where you look, it is an industry in decline, an industry that's getting more concentrated. in both in the amount of institutions that, what would you say, control is the wrong word, but are involved in the industry, and also the breadth of topics. So it kind of continually getting narrow and narrow and narrower, because resources are just getting more and more pooled. And so what's happening is fewer and fewer topics, and they tend to be the culture war topics, the big five, whatever everyone's arguing about at any given time. No matter whether it's a local newspaper that probably these days isn't even local anymore, or a national broadsheet, you're seeing the same type of content. And that is unfortunately a universal factor across the world.
I was thinking, the analogy that I always think about is a kind of the solar system, and, you know, you've got the sun and Jupiter as kind of the main balance of, gravity. That's the word I was looking for. And they, you know, kind of lots of things are affected by the gravitational pull of these objects. But in the middle is the asteroid belt, and there's lots of kind of chaotic, quite broadly dispersed, but chaotic kind of interaction between things. And it's kind of, you're trying to explain to people, well, we're not just, you know, we're drawn towards Jupiter, but we don't, you know, we also have to be able to experience these other models, which doesn't, you know, doesn't, you know, kind of, we connect with them in different ways, and we have to plan our route through those areas in different ways than we would do if we were just, you know, heading towards the main big object. And it influences your mindset then, because then you're thinking, you know, typically people cannot conceive. I mean, it's probably here in the UK. I'm of the opinion that at the moment, people are kind of, there's a fairly kind of maybe a delusional state that we think many of our cultural and social institutions are going to be with us for a long time. I think the BBC could disappear within 5 years.
Oh, easily.
There's a tipping point for these things. And it's like, you have to be prepared, and you have to re-explain what the benefit and the value of having an institution is, and the way it does things. And I'm in favor of the general principles of that kind of institutional approach. I think at this point we need that, but there's no logical reason to say why it should continue to exist if something else comes along, which provides a better job, which is why the blockchain and the decentralized media model is what appeals to me, as a kind of, we need to figure out what the processes and values are that drive this, you know.
Yeah, as long as we can recreate that, and that's the big key. If we recreate just social media again, we will need the BBC to continue to exist. But if we can recreate the type of content, the type of public service media, the type of unbiased, as well as it tries, we're not completely unbiased, but BBC does a really, 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 tries really hard to be, well, then maybe we have a more efficient model to deliver that type of thing. And then maybe we can let it go. But I certainly wouldn't dare suggest or even think about that until we are up and running a good 5 and 10 years and we've proved we can deliver this type of thing.
What's it like when you're talking to people and do you have to sell this as an idea to people, or is it, you know, kind of, it's something that people understand, is that kind of intuitive? I was looking at the Rogers innovation diffusion curve, which you covered the last couple of weeks in some blogs and things. And it's kind of like, you know, don't go for the early, the early adopters, kind of, they're going to get it. You know, don't walk into a room, try and sell what you're doing. You want to be talking to those people who already get it.
That's a good, very good point.
everybody else will come along, you know, when they're ready to.
That's an amazing point. And it's kind of where I've arrived at, because when you are talking to a journalist who's been working for 20 years in the industry, and you come across, this is extremely disruptive. I'm ripping up and reimagining it completely, how media works, from business models to review to, like, it's completely anathema to how they work. And the vast majority of them are extremely skeptical. Now, if you sit down for a very long time and tell them how, give them numbers on, for example, how much Wikimedia takes in and tips every year, and how much more we can take in by reducing the friction of not having to whip out your credit card, not asking for $20, $30 in one go, but actually just 20 cents in one go. It's much more surgical. There's no subscription. And when you get down to that nitty gritty, you can start seeing them go, maybe, but it's a hell of a lot of work to do. Where if you have, for example, journalists in crypto already get this, so I don't have to win them over. There's hundreds and thousands of them. So there is a quick win. And then just, I guess, people coming out of college and you know, there's not the journalists coming out of college is not exactly a wash with opportunities, unfortunately, these days, as, and they're younger. So they are more amenable to it. So that's probably where I'm going to start. Instead of trying to win over the established people, I'm going to just create this parallel system. And my experience in blockchain and crypto actually already speaks to that, because when it first came out, 2015, 16, 17, and people were building what's called decentralized finance, you had all these Wall Street and City of London types going, we can do that. We have these systems that can do that. What problem is this solving? And there was absolutely zero point in winning them over. So what happened was you had this parallel financial system being built by people who weren't financiers before, self-taught, and ended up building this thing that's now worth hundreds of billions of dollars, this entire system, more locked up in certain areas. And now the Wall Street people are having their heads turned and going, we need to build on this stuff. We need to get involved. The Black Rocks of this world, JP Morgan's. So that's exactly what you've described. And I think that's what we are going to have to do too. That's our strategy, I guess.
I mean, as the kind of cryptocurrency stuff is, it doesn't do itself any favors by the way it market. You know, a lot of people market this as it's almost kind of scams and betting and things like that. You know, it doesn't give me confidence to want to engage.
It's got the worst. It's got the worst detractors and the worst boosters. It's the worst of the worst are debating each other. And that is, and again, that's again what media brings to the fore, our current systems. But you've got people making promises the tech can't currently, you know, writing checks the tech can't currently cash. And then detractors just with a litany of straw men, you know, arguing as things realistic people like myself would have never claimed. And this is unfortunately the discourse around it. And then, of course, because it was a dot-com-esque boom, no matter what tech, no matter what it is you're dealing with, that just brings the worst out of humanity. So we are now probably kind of at a, if you talk about the Gartner hype cycle, we've had that peak of elated, whatever, expectations. Now we're in the trough of disillusionment. But to be honest, as someone who is realistic about what the tech can achieve and is realistic and has genuine aims about improving media, it's probably a good time to be building, because you've weeded out the nefarious people. You've weeded out the people who are just there for a cash grab. And if you're seen to be working through this time when it's no longer in vogue, money's no longer easy to come by, it gives you more a sense of legitimacy, I guess.
There's a concept which I'm again talking a bit more about recently, which kind of one of those, as you described earlier, you get this point where it just crystallizes, and it's kind of, you say, the jigsaw pieces fall into place.
Yeah.
And it's the work on around the foundational economy, which is that it's you look at things like our media not as a purely as a marketplace transaction, but you look at it as a social need. So we don't run our libraries and schools on the basis of a free market approach. Some might advocate that we should do that, but we don't presently. And you build accordingly about their investment as institutions and things like that, and cultural centers.
Yeah.
And that adopt an approach to our media, which is similarly looking at people's needs.
Yes.
And meet and facilitate in ways to meet those needs.
The way I look at it is that, and all the things you've listed there, and I include media in this, is what I would call public goods. A thing that is not actually generally best served by private markets in many senses, but you actually can, like tipping in itself is a private market. Quadratic funding competitions is a private market, but then it can be free to read. So what we're trying to push is kind of private markets for public goods, in the sense that they're not exclusionary. There's no gateway. It's a public library. It's a public resource that anyone can use. But it also has the best things about private market competition. So a lot of charities, I don't know if it's the same in the UK, in Ireland, for example, if you want to be a charity in some sector, if somebody else has been given a charity in that sector, they won't give you another permit, for want of a better word. I'm not sure what they're exactly called. And that means that's that charity alone. And like, if that starts doing a bad job, like it's almost guaranteed it will start doing a bad job because nobody's keeping on its toes. So if we can meld the two, I guess, take the best things from private markets, but reduce the amount of concentration, they tend to centralization, and then take the best things from public goods, because nothing better for humanity than open information, open, accessible, ungated information. That's how we progress. It's literally how we are today versus our cavemen ancestors, right? And that, I guess that's the dream.
One of the ironic things is, I think I'm in favor of markets. I'm in favor of capitalism, but an awful lot of people are against capitalism in a headline kind of placard waving kind of way. And I think what we and partly that's capitalism's fault, because there's been a kind of, you know, I always think, you know, the people who now control and own the media corporations in the United States, and the level of concentration and uniformity and homogenization and efficiency model that they've adopted has actually been counterproductive and has fueled opposition. Whereas if they kind of said to themselves, hang on a minute, if we go to be careful what you wish for is always a good, you know, kind of a good thing to ask, because what you do can invert into its opposite. So, you know, you end up with, you know, a concentration, the grocery markets, the cars, no competition and no innovation. And the tech giants followed exactly the same model, you know, Apple doesn't innovate, it buys innovators, you know, that's the business it's in kind of thing. And it works for them on a globalized scale, but it's left too many people behind, and local engagement and local levels of things. So that, you know, there's a kind of a top-downness to, you know, to the market, which is that these are the 550 products that most supermarkets stock, and that's all you want and all you can expect, and that we're going to sell them to you regardless of what your individual needs and opinions are, and there's nowhere else you can go for anything else. And that strikes me as a kind of a failure of market thinking.
I would call it a failure of mechanism design, because a market can be structured any way you want it. And this is a thing we spent a huge amount thinking about. How do we design these markets so they won't end up in concentration? And you can apply that. It's not limited to our use case media. You can apply it to Apple. Another place where it really should be applied is land, you know, particularly because you can't innovate more land in the world. You know, a simple way to stop concentration of land ownership would be a land tax. Because when you do renovations on your home, it makes your home worth more, but it also makes your neighbor's home worth more, because your street a more desirable place to live. And your neighbor gets the freeload on that, particularly if let's say they're just not living there anymore. It's actually an absentee landlord and it's going derelict. That's a market failure. And all you need is a simple land tax. So you can have something like that for Apple. In our system, you get excluded from funding markets. All you have to do is point markets in a way you want them to go. They're a neutral tool. They can be bad, they can be good. And when you see outcomes like you've just spoken about, that's a failure in design rather than capitalism in the big C word.
What's the role for government and regulation in this sense? Because I use the word regulation, everybody, it's an impulse to say, oh, it's a terrible thing. We have regulated protections.
Yes.
Protections for small operators, new entrants, all those kind of things. And we're starting, it's very interesting in the UK, the response from Keir Starmer to the tariffs, the Trump tariffs, are, you know, we are going to protect, you know, parts of the British, you know, productive economy, what's left of it. And it's like an actually a turnaround in terms of, you know, kind of response, which would be anathema to, a Labour government in 97 and Conservative governments previous to that. But it's like it needs must. But I'm diverting us into something else. But it's that, you know, what is there a role then to say? Because I'm a distributionist by economic, which is the EU's principle of subsidiarity.
Yes.
And that which should be done at the lowest level. Should be done at the lowest level. And it's kind of like, but somebody has to be the guiding hand to make sure that that's a fair and equitable distribution of market opportunity.
Yeah, I totally agree. So we are built on the exact same principle of subsidiarity. Once the protocol goes live, everything gets taken at the level, every decision gets taken at the level it should be. And the authority, once we've made it live, is just the what we call smart contracts that regulate the entire system. But we do what we are basically central planners as overlayers. So once we've launched that version one that we cannot change, we take user feedback. They might go, we're not getting, fact checkers, the bounty isn't big enough for them. It's not worth their while. Or, any type of problems could be brought up. And then we take that into account for version two. We build it. And crucially, this is all open source. So let's say we start taking a bigger cut for token holders, because there is a capitalism aspect to this as well. And this is what makes, again, sets crypto apart. It enables developers to monetize open source software. So, you know, there isn't this tragedy of the commons anymore and that big tech just fills. We get to take on big tech because we get to profit from it as well. You know, I'm not doing this altruistically. I'm trying to make money. But let's say we start taking too big a share for other people's liking, they can just download our open source code from GitHub and then set up Olus with another name and compete with us. Literally, that's all they have to do, one click. So we are kept on our toes. Like, there's no better accountability mechanism for us developers. But then in terms of what direct role for the government, we're actually trying to, and again, this is down to us being responsible. We try to recreate all the regulations that exist for centralized institutional media right now, plus all the editorial controls that exist within the more studious or whatever, you know, the good publications. We implement them as smart contracts. And we think we can just do that without government insight. And we think it's actually our control. And we think it's actually desirable, because if we are resistant to that, it means we can operate in authoritarian regimes. Journalists can do their job without being persecuted. They can write on the pseudonyms and nobody can take their money away because it's all on the blockchain. But it also means us getting it right from a moral, ethical point of view. Stuff like, is this in the public interest or is it an invasion of private life? And then like that's the real tricky one for us. It's like, because that's, you get into a subjective situation. Another thing is libel, and it's the least developed part of our protocol, because I'm trying to get all the economics incentives right. So this thing's economically self-sustaining, sustainable. We have local news, we have all this stuff. But when we get into these are legal questions. And then, do we have a decentralized legal board, and what jurisdiction is it adhering to? These are open questions, and that is the one place we will probably have to give the government some sort of, now when I say the government, governments we trust, EUs of this world, the UKs of this world, the US, Australia, if it's Putin or North Korea, we're probably not going to listen to them, but yeah, that is a challenge for sure.
You've actually touched on a couple of points I wanted to ask you about. Was one, dealing with incumbent advantage, two, which is the kind of values driven approach, which I think is what you talked about, and then three was the kind of the resisting the autocracy, pushback, if you like, of those kind of Putin-esque and whoever else. So it implies that there's a set of values that drive this. How would you describe them?
First and foremost, free press, freedom of speech. This is the press exists to hold the powerful to account in society, so therefore there must be a huge wall between for the government to interfere in the press. The bar has to be massive. So first and foremost, freedom of press, but then that has to be balanced with the press, particularly a journalist on this protocol that has a huge following, has the capacity to ruin somebody's life. And it might even be the truth, but it might also not be in the public interest. People have private lives. So that's another fundamental right, the right to privacy. That is going to be a hard thing to balance. particularly when the legal recourse, because we are going to allow journalists to write under pseudonym, because if we want someone to be able to criticize Putin and not have their, not suddenly fall out of a window a few weeks later, we have to have this bulletproof system where A, their identity can be hidden, but they get to carry over their track record, by the way. So you get to write anonymously or pseudonymously, and but be trusted because everyone can see you've carried over this track record. So they won't just go, this is some conspiracy theorist. But then we have to marry that with someone in our societies that might overstep the line about what they should do. And I think what we probably will have is, because humans won't get there until everything, all our review, unlike newspapers, all our review happens subsequent to publication. So what we will probably have is AI that will read it in a split second and it can raise a flag. And as soon as it raises a flag, it doesn't get deleted from the system, but it gets blinded until a committee of humans goes, well, I guess this is bringing in the equivalent of the editorial review, and but it probably might even be a legal review, goes, are we going to allow this happen? What may happen is, in the gray area ones, we may go, you can't do this as a pseudonym. You have to put your real identity to this, and then you're going to be accountable by your government if they found you've gotten this wrong.
So you're looking at X and going, there's clearly some lessons to be learned from how to do this. What are the things that have been concerning you about the way Musk has shifted X to a different model, and what would you think the benefits and disadvantages of?
Musk came in and as a self-proclaimed free speech maximalist, and then proceeded to take down a whole lot of journalists that Narendra Modi said he didn't like, I think there was cases in Turkey as well, and left other people up who were very questionable in terms of what they were saying in other jurisdictions like Europe and stuff. So it became quite clear that he was more acting out of economic interest. Free speech wasn't a guiding principle for him. It was just a marketing ploy. And this is the problem with centralized control, hierarchical control. So, you know, immediately we take that problem out. Now, if responding to government requests, if there's no body to respond, which there isn't, that can create a lot of conflict and governments might find that hard. So we really need to get our controls right for us to stay on the right side of the good jurisdiction, shall we say. And then another thing X has implemented is community notes, we actually welcome. It's as a first step to crowdsourced quality control. But the problem with community control notes is it tends to only get put on when the horse is already bolted, it's already gone viral. And there's no mechanism to force the people who read it to go see the note. They may never see the note. And that's one problem. And the second problem is there's a lot of studies that the way things have gone online, it's so bad. Even when a person sees the note, they tend to just stick with what they'd read in the first place. So basically the horse is bolted. So we need a way of getting that, bringing that process forward. I think AI is going to be a huge, a lot of the fact checkers on our protocol are going to be AI algorithms. Now they can only be one per person, so they'd be attached to some guy's account, but they might do that. Some guy might have an AI reading 1,000 articles a day, fact checking, and that could be a source of income for him. Passive income, shall we say.
The House of Lords in the UK they've launched a inquiry into media literacies, and I posted a blog this morning, which kind of the submission I'll make is that we need a participatory active form of media literacies where people understand how media is made and how those ideas are contested and checked and verified, rather than just a consumption based model. And it kind of implies that there's got to be something about, I wrote this down, was citizenship. So online citizenship is different from in-person citizenship, where there are many values that are shared, that there's going to, what you're describing in a way is a kind of there has to be some people have to take accountability and responsibility for what they do. You can't just pass it over to the system. You can't just
pay the
economic model of this. Everybody's got to do that. So how do you think you will draw those people in who really do appreciate that they need to have some responsibility and accountability for what they do and lead the way on that?
Sure. It's all about the incentives. So from the journalist's perspective, they know when they post, they're literally putting a bounty for people to find fault. So straight away, that keeps them on their toes. And their payouts are going to be determined by what they're scored. Readers are incentivized to be critical, not just to swallow it whole. They're actually going, if you find fault with this and a jury agrees with you on that, you can make money. So straight away, it changes the calculus. Instead of just swallowing this whole, instead of just finding someone who's buttressing my worldview, can I find fault with this person? That's from the global incentive, but we can't just assume rational individual economic actor either, the Milton Friedman way. As much as all I appreciate a lot of his work, the world is much more complex than that. We also assume there can be collusion. So we have to have all these kind of controls in place. For example, we have proof of unique human. So you won't be able to set up multiple accounts on this. We'll have biometrics. Now, you won't have your eyeball or your face or anything on the blockchain. That would be dystopian. What you do is you have hardware that scans it and then puts a hash, a unique hash that could only have been created by your biometrics. If you try to set up another account, you won't be able to. And then you can have one bot, because bots, if harnessed correctly, accountable bots can also be very good. They're extremely efficient. They can do things very quickly and much quicker than we can. But you can only have one per account as well. So, and then there are anti-collusion mechanisms. So you can't go, okay, you can only have one account, but then you could also collude with other accounts. So you can't get on the phone with everyone going, journalists can't go, here, can you read this and give it a good score? Because we have pairwise voting. If the same people are always voting together, either across journalists or with the same journalists, they eventually, their influence on the result gradually declines to the point it gets to zero. And they'll be told, you can vote on this, but you're going to have zero weight. There's anti-bribery protocols, all sorts of, and these are the things that took us a long time to perfect. And these are this, when I was talking about the jigsaw falling into place, the blockchain was only the first thing. We needed this proof of unique human. We needed minimal anti-collusion mechanisms. We needed I won't go into Bayesian truth serum that basically stops markets devolving into a popularity contest. All these things, these disparate tech, but new, we brought together, and I had this eureka moment. I go, okay, I can actually build a trustworthy media system here.
Right. Well, I'm sold. A couple of last questions, the easy ones is, before I ask you where people can get in contact with you, it's just kind of what's exciting you is, I mean, what is that thing of kind of, you know, you that moment, describe that moment when the jigsaw puzzle piece, because this is what gets you out of bed in the morning, doesn't it? You know, you're kind of going, there's all these challenges. I don't really know what I'm doing. Looking into the unknown, and it's like, and I've got to go and try and convince all of these other people. What drives you for that?
I guess it is absolutely, I don't know, cutting edge in terms of the tech we're using. Plus, this is as disruptive as it gets. You're taking on some of the most powerful people in society. And there's a genuine belief we can do this. And I have absolutely no illusion it's going to be a hard slog. I've got a 20-year roadmap here. I'm not here to sell out once I get to 5 years in or whatever. I guess the excitement of hopefully creating something world-changing is the short answer to that question.
And then the next question that follows from that is, what should I be asking? Who should I be talking to? And what should we be talking about that will facilitate and improve and develop this approach?
Like you as in you?
As in, more broadly, you know, kind of colleagues who work in community media, colleagues who work in institutional media, colleagues who work in,
right,
you know, media reform, you know, it's kind of, you know, yeah, it's, you know, generally what should we be looking towards?
Okay, well, you know, I have been all in on the mechanism design stuff, the security stuff, making thing this be bulletproof against concentrated interests, against collusion, against control, so we actually achieve our goals of this pluralistic, sustainable, self-sustaining, sustainable media industry. So that's the economic side of things and the tech side of things that I, A, would know a lot about myself, and B, have people to lean on. But we still should take this. I'm going to start doing a lot more outreach to practitioners. Don't get me wrong, I've been doing it all along, otherwise I wouldn't be doing my job. But I'm going to start concentrating a lot more on that. So I'd love to have conversations with people who care about these things. And then also, mainly, you can build all this amazing system, but without people riding on it, you don't have a product. And people always ask me, what is a chicken and egg problem? What do you go here for? The demand side is supply side first. I'm always the supply side. Get the journalists there. For the first 3 years, we're under no illusions. The bank accounts aren't going to be on a blockchain for many, many years. So for the first 3 years, we're just going to issue tokens. So it'll be investor subsidized. So you can come on this platform, write, earn tokens. And don't get me wrong, you'll only earn them if you're good at what you do. But you can be an early adopter. The analogy I use is, imagine you were an Uber driver in San Fran in 2011 and they paid you half in equity. You'd be doing pretty damn well right now. And that's, you know, that's the carrot. The stick is you have to be accurate because you've got people.
deliver people to their destination.
Exactly. There you go. Good man.
Okay. So where, I mean, this has been fantastic. Where can people, where do you want people to look to find out? I mean, I'll put links in and everything, but it's, where's the main thing?
The website is olus.info, and there's a forum attached to that as well as a link for a forum. I'm happy to join. If you want to, anybody has any questions, how it works, how they'd like to get involved, or if they want to get involved, that's the place to do it. We're also on X, at Olus Protocol, or at Olus underscore protocol, maybe, but you'll find a search for Olus Protocol. There's also on the website extensive technical docs, if that's what you want to do, about 30,000 words of deep, deep stuff. But, you know, some people might want to read that. And yeah, that's essentially where you'll find all the information.
Wonderful. This has been fantastic. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It pushed me to my limits and kind of returning back to my simplistic, you know, I'm very much web 2.0. You know, I've got a blog, I do a podcast.
Yeah, but you've got the media, you know, you've deep knowledge of the media, you've deep knowledge of problems and where, how we can improve things. I was reading a lot of your stuff. Like, we have absolute similar ethos and desires for what we want to see here, I think.
Well, I set up my business called Decentered Media on the basis of, you know, it's like, what are we going to do? What are the values that we need? What are the, you know, I'm not necessarily talking about systems for me. It's more kind of, how do we, you know, inculcate a culture of citizenship, responsibility, communication, empowerment, all those kind of things, which kind of you will need in this system, in this approach going into the future. Deferring this to, you know, other people to solve your problems because they're somehow projected as being better informed. Yeah. Or, you know, there was always a classic thing about I'll relate this story, and is the Queen Elizabeth in 2009-10, something like that, visited the Canary Wharf to see all the big banks and everything, and she asked the question, why did nobody see the crash coming? And sometimes, you know, too many clever people all working together on the same problems is a problem. You need people who can ask those, you need people to say, I don't understand this. You know, what do you do with this? It doesn't make sense to me. So that's kind of where I see myself fitting in with this. But it's also a practical level, you know, at some point you've got to roll your sleeves up and learn how to tell a story. Yeah. So the platform and the system can be there, but somebody needs to know what is their neighbor's needs are.
Yeah.
And they need to know what is the most, and not everybody thinks in behaviorist, kind of logical, rational terms. Most people are actually quite, you know, kind of informed by emotion or symbolic thinking. There's a whole range of other factors that inform why and how people do things. And it's like, you've got to approach this on a multiple level. It is a complex set of of interacting kind of activities. And he's like, that's interesting to me. That's where it's fascinating. So,
and
you seem to have crossed over for, you know, into that quite, you know, you've retained that knowledge and experience of thinking about this as a social science issue as much as a technical platform issue.
100%. Exactly. It's about tools and incentives, and the tools is the tech. The incentives is the social science part, where, and you know, Charlie Munger just died, great quote, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. And we are seeing the outcome of the incentives that exist in media right now. And we just need to change that game, basically. I also, to your point about looking for other people to tell us what the truth is, I read this amazing book, Super Forecasters by Philip Tetlock. He did a 20-year study expert political forecasters, academics making judgments. And he literally did this. He had a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. And they were outperformed the monkey by 2 percentage points or something like that. So we rely, amongst the middle class, the metropolitan elite, what I call them, I'm part of that. There's a real trust in people with, you know, so-called expertise or, you know, letters behind their name or whatever, overly so. And don't get me wrong, I'm not here to denigrate that is earned, but we shouldn't just take it for granted. We need to have our own critical faculties. And I find we're devolving far too much these days, because I guess we're just so inundated with information, it's more efficient to hand over responsibility to somebody else.
Wonderful. Well, a big inspiration of mine is Marie-Louise von Franz, who's a colleague of Carl Jung, and she said, what's the hardest question to ask anybody? What do you think?
Oh, yeah, you're dead right.
We defer too much to everybody else, but if you figure out what you can think for yourself, then even in part, it's you're at an advantage then. So this has been wonderful. Thank you very much. Let me wrap up and give some details about where people can get in contact with me. So it's, if you go to decentred.co.uk, I'm on X and Blue Sky and Instagram and various things like that, which I check periodically, and that's Decentred Media. If you want to support the podcast, you can do it the Web 2.0 way by subscribing at Patreon, and it is useful. It helps. Every little penny that comes in has it gives me an opportunity to go for a coffee at least and de-stress. But until next time, thanks very much. You've been listening to the Decentred Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. To find out more, go to decentred.co.uk or follow on Twitter and Instagram @decentredmedia.